Culture eats strategy approach, and informed cultures drive decisions and inspire action. At the Data Culture Podcast, we talk with execs, visionaries, and data experts so that you may move from idea to outcome in your own data culture journey. Welcome to the Data Culture Podcast. My name is Sid Atkinson, data culture innovator and consulting leader with over 21 years in data.
And I'm Lee Harper, AI human with over a decade doing AI and data science. And today we're joined by Jody Blumberg. So Jody is a very seasoned data science executive after a long spell at analytics giant FAS. She's held very senior roles at Charles Schwab, Waste Management, and is currently VP Data Science at Cox Automotive. And she'll be sharing a range of very interesting insights with us today that she's gleaned and learned over her career. So welcome, Jody.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jody, one of the things that you're known for and regularly speak on is how to do things like mix data science with good discipline and good process. So one of the things that we discussed is how to integrate Agile. Of course, can be a controversial topic in software engineering circle with the data science process, which it may have been famous for being relatively nebulous and potentially undisciplined. Why don't we start with some of your thoughts and views and what you've successfully done to take good bits of Agile and combine that with the data science process?
I think it goes without saying that model development, AI, ML, data science model development just is a little different than software engineering. And so it can feel like a bad fit. And there's a temptation just to not do it because it's really hard to commit sprints in software. The code defines the logic that controls the system. In modeling the model, the data have code that learns the logic. And that differential can create a lot of uncertainty, a lot of cycling. It's very common for data scientists to go back. But I'm a firm believer that we should do Agile anyway, because one reason is your whole goal was to get deployed into a software product, presumably, or some kind of code. So you better figure out how to get along with the software engineers, right? They have questions. When are you going to be done? How long is it going to take? How do I put a dependency on you? Those are all fair questions. And Agile,
how much money do you need?
The other thing you get out of the discipline too is actually as a data science leader, you can say a lot about the productivity of your team. Although you should be very careful when you do that. So first, I just believe in Agile might. So Agile by itself doesn't quite fit data science. And when we're in deep R&D phase where we're just testing the feasibility of an idea, I generally am not a huge fan of trying to do Agile that. But once we feel like we're on a product roadmap and we need to deliver a model to someone, we have to start using features and sprints and things that resonate with the people who are about to receive our model so they understand where the delays are or whether we have dependencies on them. And I call it, I guess it's Agile light. It's not strict Agile, but it allows you to have that conversation back and forth with software engineering and ML ops teams that are running on Agile, which is just if you want to get the work done, I think you have to do that.
One thing that I regularly observe is data science teams often do work in this little bubble of innovation, or they have this R&D budget. And culturally, they can struggle to communicate with wider teams, such as software engineering, such as MLOps and DevOps, such as even the business in some cases. How do you go about forming those connections with those wider teams that, of course, are critical for the overall success of the project?
Sometimes it is education, because we make them nervous, right? We have high uncertainty. If you'd like to make a product owner nervous, right? Like, you will, because sometimes they come to you with an idea. Can you build a model that does X? And your answer is, why? I don't know. I might have to build it to see if the data is good enough to get to the place you want to get to. And still being really disciplined and time boxed about R&D efforts, I think is really important just so you continue to win trust. But once you've proven out that feasibility, then I think you can have more sprints and things that they recognize. It's not perfect. Don't get me wrong. But if I had one rule of thumb, like my bare minimum for Agile, is that you should be able to put dependencies on another team and they need to be able to put dependencies on you. Because it's okay if you tell the software engineering team, I can't do that till the data engineering team does this, till that data is loaded. That's a great conversation. That helps everybody understand. The product owner now understands the timeline and the order of events. It's less good if everyone's been waiting on data science and I don't know what they're doing. That's really what we're trying to avoid. In those R&D phases, whether that comes to us from product or comes to us even we're getting a little ahead of product, with those, you still want to be disciplined, but at that point, I'm usually not on the product roadmap, so I don't sweat so much the sprints. I sweat more my internal clock, which is about 4 to 6 weeks. I think if you can't define an R&D project where you can have a result in 4 to 6 weeks, so maybe you don't solve the whole problem, but you figure out how to narrow a hypothesis test, or even if it's data exploration to figure out if the problem we're doing, if you can't get that done in about 4 weeks, you need to think smaller. You need to report progress, and you need to keep making those go, no-go decisions all along the way. If you disappear into a silo for 6 months, A, you'll have gotten no feedback, so you don't even know if it's good. And B, people will be wondering what you've been doing for 6 months, right? The dig on data science is, well, I don't know what they're doing, and that's not good. I want everyone to know what we're doing.
Yeah, you might come back and somebody else is at your desk.
Yep.
So you mentioned, I wrote down one question here. How do you determine when, because there's going to be a lot of agile purists that are like, oh my God, Jody, what did you just say? How do you determine when to do agile light versus normal agile? Because you are drawing in your head a distinction between these two things. So one, maybe you're letting everybody have their hair down, and the other one, you're like, nope, that's got to be up because he might get caught in the machinery.
Okay. A lot for me is where we are in the cycle. Again, if we are in pure, what I consider to be more pure R&D, I am not on a product roadmap yet. I'm doing the feasibility to determine if I should be, model should be, that may not even run an agile light past the 4 to 6 week, let's run a hypothesis test. Once I'm on a product roadmap, we run agile, but I never get past what, I guess I call it agile light, because the only part that's lighter in my mind is we may not run things in 2 week sprints. Maybe that this thing takes 2 sprints.
Yeah.
Our deliverables may look a little different. A deliverable for us may not be a code commit or a demo. A deliverable might be, we have done our exploratory data analysis. We have time capped that to 4 weeks, which, by the way, is a great side benefit because data scientists, me included, I can stay there all day. Like, you're look at more stuff. So you've time capped your exploratory data analysis to maybe say 2 sprints. So your deliverable is actually a presentation. Here's what we found in the data. Here would be the gaps we need to fill in order to go to market. Here are the things the data engineering team, I need them to fix this data quality issue. So there's this clear set of actions and dependencies you could put maybe on other people. It also may be a go, no-go decision. We certainly sometimes end that period and go, you literally don't have the data to do the thing you want to do. So we need to run an experiment to collect it because you have no variance. I find that a lot with event pricing and marketing spend and things like that when people work recommendation around that. If they've just been charging everyone the same amount for the same day, for the same time, all the time, there's no variance. There's nothing to learn. That's one way we sometimes will cut it off too, right? All those deliverables to be places that are largely go, no-go decisions. Should we keep going? Should we test another hypothesis so that everyone knows where we are? Like that product owner knows, oh, I'm 6 months from going to market with that, or it's ready to go.
It's interesting you bring that up. And it's something that honestly I see as a lost art for a lot of software dev. In that we had the concept of research spikes and exploratory analysis and other things like that, wherein the deliverable isn't code. And the deliverable might just be, it's like, I needed to go figure out like the technical capabilities, like the competitive product or a different platform. And it's research and reading API docs or something like that. So I'd almost say it's like where maybe y'all are relearning things that software has forgotten and shouldn't have forgotten.
Okay, I'll take that. Because surely software engineers have to do this sometimes, right?
They do, yeah. Timmy, to your point, their world's like less gray in some areas because they're creating the new reality, whereas you're dealing with everybody else's reality and see what additional layers and insights can be put on the reality. But yeah, they have that stuff too. It's just we see it frequently forgotten because people turn into feature factories versus pursuit of a problem.
It's easy to get busy,
right?
It's hard to busy.
We could also spin out models that no one uses, but... Trying not to do that.
How do you go about defining those R&D phases? So you've got a thing that you say, okay, I'm going to spend 4 weeks, 2 sprints, doing a hypothesis test. It's very easy to define hypotheses that are either too narrow or way too broad. How do you or your teams go about right-sizing the hypothesis or the R&D spikes to that kind of time box period?
There's usually 3 components. One is clearly data. If I already have access to, if the team already has access to most of the data that we want, then you have a better idea of what you can do, right? Then an exploratory data analysis, for example, deliverable is great because it's landed, it's there. If it's not that, then some of it might be that I'll get someone to get data, and our clock won't start ticking until that data's there. The second is the business usually, or the product owner, right? Try to get them to tell you what's the most important thing. What would be the deal breaker for them? So if it could be that I cannot take a model with an error higher than this, which, okay, maybe we can't deliver that. Let's go figure that out. Because the dirty secret is, I think of model development is, because I see this in, sometimes when software engineers build machine learning models, they're like, I got to 80% accuracy. Give me another couple weeks. I'm like, oh no, the first 80 is the easy part. Percent after that will cost you blood and tears. So I need this to be 90% accurate and you get to 85 on the first try. That is not, I'm nervous. I want to be like 89%. So I can get to 90. It's much harder to get the last bit of accuracy a lot of times, especially with like XGBoost and stuff. They've learned a lot about the variance that's there. So you're going to have to work pretty hard to get more. I'm looking at data and looking at the business partner and the product owner. What is the most important thing? You're trying to narrow that hypothesis to, can I move that conversation along for us to decide whether to go or not? It could be that they have certain business process restrictions. I could never put that in front of a customer, or I could never ask someone to do that, right? And, hey, test whether I can do something even knowing that restriction is out there. Things like that. I'm looking for pretty narrow. And I'm also looking for a third piece of input, which is go ask your data scientist. If I tell you you need to come back to me in 4 weeks of this, are you crying or are you like, no problem? So try to gauge their temperature. Unless they are totally green to the problem, they may have looked at this data before and say, I probably can spit that out. I definitely get them. They are also allowed to come back to me. This is part maybe. Does this happen in software engineering? I don't know. They are allowed to come back to us after, say, 2 sprints and say, I know I said I could do X, but boy, when I looked at that data, it looking like I'm only going to get to here. My great, come tell us what you found as far as you got.
Yeah, I would say just from the software engineering side, I'd say this is like a reformed software engineer started off doing like the development before I got into data, but led a lot of teams. It's like you get nervous when people estimate anything over 3 days because developers are notoriously bad at estimating anything. Pretty good 1 to 3 days on effort. Past that starts the quality degrades. And it's not because they're bad. It's just because everything from scope creep, assumptions, all this other stuff gets in there very quickly. So no, it is not just a data science issue. It is a general people.
It is, and we have, so. And I think one thing I chafe really far away, or I run away from at will, is why I'm agile is, I don't judge my team on sprint velocity. I don't judge my team on a lot of the engineering metrics. I think you have to tread really carefully too with data science teams. You don't want a faster model if it's a worse one, but you also don't want them to spin forever. So we try not to reward speedy but crappy work. We try to reward things like, did you deliver in the time committed, right? To encourage good scoping, things like that. Metrics drive behavior, and I'm trying to encourage good behavior.
That's awesome.
And that's actually a really good point. One, that you actually have metrics around it. I feel a lot of data science teams maybe would benefit. Given that we deal with data, metrics are our bread and butter. It's surprising how few actually have metrics on themselves. But to your point, as with any kind of data science optimization problem, the objective function, the metrics, drive how the model performs, and humans are no different, right? We will optimize to whatever our job says is optimal.
Yep. I look at three, like I don't have sprint velocity. I look at dollars, because if we're not making a lot of money, not counting that in your data science leader, stop doing whatever you're doing. So we do first. And then I try to track volume. And what I mean by that is like, how many features did we deliver, or how many API calls are coming off that model? Just make sure we're making stuff that gets used. Product owner has some responsibility there too, but that's just a good tracking mechanism for us. We see a model not being used as much. Is there something wrong, right? We don't have logging here, but we have a different problem. Or we have concept drift or something. People are ignoring it. And then the third one are those efficiency metrics. How productive is my data science team? And those are the ones I think you have to be the most careful about. Candidly, we're running kind of an experiment right now, or we got a lot more continuity and discipline around how we're doing our time management within the Agile framework amongst my data science team today. And in about 2 more weeks, we'll have our first set of metrics. We're going to throw them all away if we hate them. We tried to design our own around this efficiency thing to try to figure out how to engender good behavior. And we're just running an experiment on ourselves. We're not going to judge anybody on them yet. We're just trying to figure out what we should do. that will make good sense, because I still think you should be have to answer the question like a software engineering team does, like, how many of there should there be? Are you doing what you should be doing? How fast are you doing it? I think that's an okay thing to ask of any team.
No, I think it's great that you've got several metrics that you look at. It's funny how this, to me, this conversation has dropped off the radar, but there's, gosh, when I was first doing data, we talked a lot about balanced scorecard methodology. And the goal of it was that you made sure that as you looked at changes in one area, that you made sure that it was balanced in the other area so you didn't end up with distortions, right? So what you're saying is I could chase the dollar impact, but if I also don't look at some of the other things, I could, you know, end up optimizing for the wrong thing. And so to your point, it's like, hey, how productive, right? If I have to run 10 things to get one really good outcome, was it a 90% waste? Or that's, but I, out of those 10, I had to do like a bunch of high risk experiments in this case. And then that one thing that actually worked, one problem they were pursuing, 10 experiments, and one just knocked it out of the park. So it's the balance on those things that I, oddly enough, like it's, I've seen drop from the conversation. People aren't, balance scorecard was huge, and then now nobody talked about those ideas. And so it's nice to hear when it's, okay, we want to look at data, but it's to inform how we're functioning, not to judge or grade, because the outcome is the most important thing.
You've gone through a budget cycle at a big company. These are things to know.
Yes.
Is also, I don't know, right? If you run a big team, I don't. When the business is, oh, I want to fund another data scientist, I'm like, I don't know. Do we need one? Do we need two? At least this gives you some ballpark of what that might look like. Historically, Matt had. It's hard to know. I mean, we're not special that way, but I'm always interested in trying to figure that out.
You've worked at a number of very well-known companies, but companies that, not Facebook, not Netflix, not Google, not the perhaps the sexy tech companies, but you've worked at a number that are bluntly crucial and central to American life, right? Charles Schwab, a ton of people have investments in retirement accounts there. Waste management, enough said. Without waste management,
yes, you do.
Right? What kind of commonalities or what kind of lessons have you seen and taken on board from the ways that AI culture or data science culture exists at those firms? So, and what have you seen that's really good? What have you seen that was perhaps challenging there? What have you had to address in your, you know, your time across those firms? Because honestly, most firms are more like those firms than Google or Facebook.
First, we have a better problem set, so I'm going to sell anyone any day. We're changing the world over. Like, how many more ways is there to solve them on something? I'm sure there's a few more. I'm just saying, well, if you just stuck IoT devices on a landfill that have never existed before, you're the first person touching that data. I think we have the funnest jobs in the world going and working at companies where AI is not core to the product. But it does present its own series of challenges. I probably should thank Gen AI. They no longer have to explain to people why AI is important. They're all excited.
And the switch got flipped in like November of 2022, right? It's the map. We don't care to.
I'll ride the train. I am not excited about the ride back down, but then there will be. And I don't intend to ride the rest of it down. But I think that the real difference of doing it at the kind of company that we do is it's not central. So because AI is not central to our product, in the way that most digitally native companies, it's very built into the processes. It's very, people are used to hearing about it, or as I have a friend at work at Facebook said, anything I dream up can happen. And I was like, right, I could dream up lots of things that never happen. Because you're going to deal with this huge amount of change management. And actually, McKinsey just came out with a study that so mirrored my experience. I love it. Which is that when you release AI in a digital model, so think of Amazon Recommender Engine is a great example. Everyone knows that is. You can think about a dollar change management for about a dollar cost in dev. So it's about $1 for $1. When you get into places where humans, like what I've been doing, right? There's a landfill engineer or a mechanic fixing a truck at Cox Automotive or someone who wants to auction floor and you're handing them technology, right? Then the ratio is more like 3-1. So about $3 of change management for every dollar of development cost. And that's a figure I would carry around at any of these companies because you need so much business buy-in in order. Because you're a change agent now, right? If you're not at one of those big digital companies, your whole job is to try to get somebody to do something differently than they've done it before. And you will get resistance and you must act consultatively. You need to prep people for that 3-1 ratio, right? hey, we're going to have to educate users. We're going to have to train them. We're going to have to educate them that we have levers we can pull on that model that can help them. So if I've got a field touch running right now where the actual person touching the model, they said, if you're wrong more than about 15% of the time, false positive, they'll probably be like me, right? Don't want to use it. But that's great information because we can pull levers and figure out which things to send people and change our thresholds in order to get to only sending you the sure stuff or whatever. But that can be quite different, I think, than living in a world where a lot of those companies are like, we retrain every day and we deploy our model every day. I'm like, if I changed it every day, someone would have my head on a platter in so many industries. And just, you have to be very realistic. On the other hand, like I said, I think we get a lot of things that no one's ever built before. So I firmly believe I have the funnest job around.
And then, I don't know, my bias on when you said, hey, we get to change some of these things every day, it's generally, not all, because there are definitely some scenarios where that volume and veracity on the change is definitely valued. But you know, but there's this bias on these large consumer facing companies where the stakes are low for those changes.
Your TikTok, right? Like retrain every day. Who cares? Great.
Yeah, or back to Amazon. Most people are going to stop using Amazon just because it accidentally recommended something I didn't want to buy. So the stakes are low. So it's that balance, just like you're saying. What's the value is typically higher and the change is harder. Like, you don't want to do those things as often, right? There's a different kinds of optimizations you might want to do, many of which might be, how do I make this easier for the other people to use? Not necessarily retraining the model or adding new features to the model.
We push updates. So on average, this is an average because I've got everything from things that do get retrained often to things that we would only touch once a year for lots of good reasons. I think we only average, we average about a 4-to-1 ratio on model redeployments to deployment. That's another metric we're tracking. That's more because if you have 100 models in production, that means you need to prep for 400 model redeployments in the next year. And model ops and I are in lockstep that we're going to automate as much of that as possible. So that's super easy because that sounds really big, right? And then every model I add, like, put at least 4 more on the next year. And that is something I look at a lot because I am always curious also about what my keep the lights on costs are. Like, where do I need data scientists to make new stuff? And where do I need them to keep the stuff we have living?
Yeah. One question I wrote down earlier, I think you and I've talked about this a little bit in the past, but maybe we haven't. When I look at data science, right, and it borrows the term science, and you usually think about science as a very disciplined field, right? Like the scientific method taught to us in grade school.
Depends which professor you work under, but sure.
Fair enough, but we still think about scientists as generally having more discipline. So how is it that we ended up with these wild-haired, unruly people as data scientists? Like, why are these folks also undisciplined when the predilection should be towards discipline?
Ooh, that's good. I think most data scientists are very disciplined about experiments or making sure that the data is right. I often find they create whole universes for themselves to make sure that the thing works. They can have this really high discipline there. Mm-hmm. But they don't have very high, the right word is corporate discipline, maybe. Right. They don't realize. And there's two reasons. One, we hire lots of PhDs who come out of academia. We're running off in a silo, presumably writing something to write a research paper is a good idea, right? We don't get paid to do that. Mm-hmm. So some of that's just like a learning curve to be like, yeah, we might do a worse thing if it's a lot faster. Right, making the business money tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We're going to call it. We're going to move on. And that requires a discipline that isn't they want to be good. So I think we get the reputation for being undisciplined because of, first of all, just of the academic. I think the second is also the weird thing is we can always be better, right? We're always like, even more data. I can model better. And so that can feel undisciplined, right? Again, back to our ad hoc, to the product teams or whatever. They're like, what are you going to be done? And I think the last reason, and it's one I watch out for, it's such a double-edged sword, which is you can run an incubation lab or pick your AI innovation lab, whatever word you want. You can make a lot of stuff that doesn't go to market. So I'm not a huge fan of that. I like being embedded in products or technology more than if I need to be in product. But because it will actually, then I'm having that good trade-off conversation with product. I can't make this perfect thing, but what if I make this thing and it works good enough, right? And I think that's a much more practical place to live, albeit less Might not. Yes, sometimes we do stuff that like totally changes the market, but a lot of times you're doing stuff that changes the market enough. But look, it makes enough money. Who cares, right? Your ROI should be sky high if you're running a data science team. You should be making a lot more money for your company than you're paying the people.
Yeah. So maybe it's not that that data scientists are disciplined as undisciplined as you're saying. It's just that the yardstick or the measurement function that we're using is the lens, right? So the viewpoint is different. So measures that work for showing discipline in a more academic world don't work in a corporate world.
No, they don't. In my I've lived in both.
All right. Jody, y'all need to create like a welcome to corporate life boot camp when you hire a new data scientist.
Mine's much shorter. It's called, we don't get paid to be smart, we get paid to be useful. That's like my one sentence boot camp.
All right. Be paid to be useful. All right, I'm writing
this
that one
for
down.
A good segue into, as we're prepping for, you were telling me about a current thing you have going on where you're using the data science methods and techniques to actually not just inform product or do product, but also to inform strategy and roadmap. I think that's a thing that people are, I think, generally pretty, not as a great at, but people I think understand how to like a product roadmap, right? Product managers know what that means. There's enough people who are good at that to have a rough idea of features, delivery dates, and so on and so forth. But I know that AI roadmaps in innovation can be a lot more nebulous because not like we deliver X feature by X date with X resources. There's more variables and factors at play there. So maybe if you could tell us a little, I think this would be a good and interesting kind of story, case study for some of our listeners to hear about.
No, I don't. So in some lines of business, first I'll say a somewhat unpopular thing, which is I don't think you need an AI strategy. I think you need business strategy and figure out how AI fits into it. Sorry, consultants.
That is a common refrain from our guests.
No, that's 100% in line with the way we think. So
I'm trying to make the business better. It's their strategy, right? They know more about the market than I do. So I have at least one business partner, and it's because we've proven our ground with a couple others where some part of our work, one hat of our work is we do stuff the product asks us to do. It's going to deliver in the next 6 to 12 months. With a known need, we make the model, they deliver it into the product. There's often this longer term view, though. What is R&D, right? It's what's the product next year? Or can I build a new product that I can sell? And if it's AI-based, I'm happy they come to us, right? But now you're wearing a consulting hat. You're not really wearing you're wearing a technical but consulting hat. And so we are trying to be really disciplined about that because I worry too, right? What am I doing? My philosophy on R&D is R&D is really just about narrowing uncertainty. That's its job. It's not about building a thing that can go to market. It's not about building necessarily a new product. It's about narrowing uncertainty about that product or about whether a model can be used for this or about whether your users will sustain this. And the approach we're taking currently with a business partner who wants to look on the longer time horizon is we have a list of hypotheses. We have a pretty clear list that we're going to test. They're prioritized. Most of them are algorithmically driven. Otherwise, maybe you don't use us for that. But in this case, these are all the things that they're very data driven. Everything they want to go to market with will probably have an algorithm behind it. And we are acting like a consulting arm with an R&D function that says, we are going to test these. We're going to report back to you whether you can do this or this, right? If it's an optimization problem, can you make both sides of the party happy? Or, hey, you can't do a good example, actually, I'll pick on my wave management days, right? But you can optimize something, maybe, but it's like the data is too unrealistic that anyone would ever take it, right? Because you're using, let's just say it's driving, right? If you don't have the actual drive time or traffic, it's probably too unrealistic to tell someone they could drive there in an hour because it takes hours sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. And so just helping them narrow those kinds of uncertainty, could you go to market with that? Would you feel comfortable? This is how wide the variance in your data is, anything we could do. So we're trying to really deliver the hypothesis roadmap, a plan to test those hypotheses, hopefully 12 hypotheses shrink to 3 or 4 things that they can feel like they can go to market with. You have to tread carefully. You want to be in lockstep with the business and in lockstep with product because eventually those things become products. And that's not you. That's not me. I don't work product. I need to be keeping them completely. I told my team, we need radical transparency to a product about what we're doing so they don't feel like we're getting too far ahead. But I think that's the funnest work. That's how you do the next big thing is that it, because I think the part I will have to educate the business on, I hope not, but I usually do, is you should be just as happy when we fail as when we succeed. I have saved you so much money because we didn't try to build the whole thing, right? So anytime we test an idea that we're like, you know what? You can't do that. Not the data you have, or that will never work. That's such good information because then nobody put it on a product roadmap, spent a bunch of time making it, and it didn't work, right? So I consider our failures to be money savers, but our big goal.
If you learn from it, right? I've had projects where the data science part didn't work out, but the actual learnings were phenomenally helpful to other parts of the business to actually do something different to make money, even though it wasn't deploying an algorithm. It was more, hey, did you know that if these two people do this differently, you can make $100,000?
I just sat in an AI
chat. The model failed, but...
We figured out something we should do that would save the company a lot of money. And I was like, but you don't need AI for that, but you're not going to offend me. What do you mean? There's no... Do it.
Yeah, so what are some of those common ways that you help folks narrow that uncertainty? Because I love that. So you either do that by... There's many ways to do that. So let me ask you, how are you helping narrow uncertainty when you're doing this R&D?
A lot of times for me, it can be that we might build a base model, right? So something that's dumb that hasn't taken in enough constraints that actually live in the real world. So we built a toy box. I hate that word. Okay. We built a toy box. We said, there's some data in, so we can probably predict this thing, but we haven't put any constraints on it. So then you go on a site visit or something, mm-hmm. right? You go visit the person. They're like, oh, I could never do that because I have to do X before Y. And you're like, great. So then you have a hypothesis to test. That's a constraint. I will go tell you, given that you don't want to change this part of your business process, here is something else you could. The model will work like this under that constraint. And then they can make that trade-off choice. Is that worth changing the business process? Or should we try to stay in our lane? Especially in these cases where a non-digital analyst, this is about, do I have the person walk this way? Or... do I have to do this task first? Or can they take a picture of that? Can they really thinking, so helping them narrow the uncertainty about those kinds of things? Because that's up to the business. If they want to change the business process, they can do that. But we're trying to help them understand, even use AI in this sort of radical throw the whole thing out way. That's super hard. Can you use it? Can I build a model that sort of builds in constraints around the way your process works? But I like to test those one at a time. So the 4 to 6 week might be, hey, let's not test the ocean. Like, how about we test this one thing, then go back and take the test.
And you mentioned field site visit. We talked about that during the prep, and I was like, that is... Because I've done that myself for, again, customers that have been more non-digital, right? You know, that had mechanics or that had sales folks or a call center. Well, Sid used to did analytics for call centers way back at Dell 20 years ago. Tell us about your philosophy around that and how you help people that have probably never set foot on a production line or a mechanic shop or in a call center in their lives. Because let's be frank, most PhDs maybe spent a summer doing that at some point in their teenage year, but probably not. How do you bridge that gap?
Well, if you work on my team, you will be sitting in a call center or walking with her. And I mean, in a good way, you should put that on everyone's development plan. They have to do a site visit the year. So in our current business, for example, they need to go visit a car auction and watch that interaction. Or if you are building a call model, you go sit behind your call center employee. I recommend this for Gen AI all the time. Those people are happy to tell you where the friction in their job is. And the part they hate, they might as well automate that part if you want a willing participant. Because remember, these people also aren't super excited that you're coming in with AI internally. There's probably some resistance. Really, I think there's no limit to the value of meeting them where they're at. The other thing you get out of that is where your data is generated. If you stand there, because you're reading the data that comes out, if you're standing there, oh, that's why I capped a bet, because you guys just turn that thing off when you just learn stuff you can't learn.
Yeah. Or it's the first in the checkbox, it's the first option that when you're a mechanic and all you want to do is fix cars, you just click the first option because you don't care about, you care about fixing the cars and having happy customers in front of you. You don't care about making my job easier as a data scientist.
Oh, and those problems can get very expensive. Back when I was doing the call center ops thing, I ended up meeting with a whole bunch of people that ran the parts depot, and they could not figure out for one of the most popular laptop models, like, why are we having all of the Gen 2 boards coming out and going leaving, and I've already got stacks and stacks of Gen 1 boards. So did you ever look at what the call center reps are? It's like, the Gen 2 board works no matter which laptop you ordered, and they're judged on first time fix. So they're going to shipping out the Gen 2 board, and nobody's picking the Gen 1 board. It's a $100 million problem.
There's I just think if you want to stay out of Toy Box Land, you got to get up there and learn the stuff. You want to know why your data looks the way it does, and you want to know. You're really trying to change the way someone works. So I hope you spend a day at least in their shoes or following them around. I just think you get much more impactful R&D out of that. And sometimes we even run field tests. We have field tests running right now. So that's where we actually deployed a model, but we got one site. To test it so we can get some feedback. And it's actually a place where sometimes I'm trying to tamp down the enthusiasm. Or, oh, you can do this. And I was like, can we see how that works out there in the wild first? And then we all be as excited as we want. Oh, fine. But I want to feel like it didn't just work on the data on the computer, but that once we actually had humans touch it, we find it so that it really does get used. Because I think it's going to be a valuable problem for us. But I really do to get on the ground if I can.
Especially when you're at an org where end-to-end, that org owns the data, right? People at that organization generate the data in their day-to-day jobs. People at the organization process that data. Your team gets that end product with all of that data-generating process having been gone through, but it's all traceable in principle. I know the practice of that can be harder, but in principle, the lineage exists, like all internally. You can indeed see literally how the person on their computer generates the data. And that's
powerful. That's the advantage, I think, of digitally native companies as well. They're pretty high information on where people click, what they're doing, right? And I tend to have lower information. I only understand from data, I can only tell where you intersected with technology. I do not know where you're intersecting with the physical world for most of. So you got to go visit.
Hmm. So last thing, you have expressed over time several, I guess, what you would call unpopular opinions. I don't know how unpopular they are, and probably among our listener base, they're probably actually quite popular. But what are some unpopular opinions that you hold and that you would like to?
I don't know if it's unpopular, but maybe I don't see it implemented. I think when you run a data science team, you absolutely need technical experts, but you are at the end of the day also a sales and marketing team. Now, GenAI has made that problem better. Right? Because I don't have to go. I spend a lot of time currently flying around to different business lines telling them about AI because now everybody wants to know. But so I don't have to push as much. But most often when you build a model, you need that function within your team, whether that's a data science manager or just some of your senior people who can do that storytelling, who can help people understand what's going on there, who are going to be patient, who can speak at the level of the customer. That a lot in data analysts or data science teams that build insights, which is not my current role, but you actually need that same function even if you're integrating into product, because you still need to be able to tell people the why and what you're doing and what business change that might confer. So I think that I'd go so far as to say is that sticking your data science team in sales training wouldn't be the worst thing you could do. There's an element of your job that is about sales and marketing. And I don't know if that's unpopular or maybe just unrecognized. I just think it's easier to get your job done.
Probably depends who you ask. I think that would make a lot of data scientists or does make them a bit squiffy inside. But also that sales doesn't have to be being a snake oil person, right? Sales can be a very consultative process. That several sales books refer to sales people as consultants. You are actually a consultant trying to solve someone's problems. And that intersection is ideally the point you want to get to. So this has been wonderful. Thank you, Jody. How might people will be able to get hold of you if they want to chat or follow up? And what exciting things are you doing in the near future?
Oh, I'm very easy to find on LinkedIn, so that's an easy way to find me. There's not anyone else with my name. Handy, but terrible for data privacy. And actually, the most exciting thing, actually, I'm excited about two things. They're coming. I've only been at Cox Auto under a year now, so about 8 months in. I'm super excited about what we're doing on that forefront stuff. I can't wait to see some of that come true. And just get to influence how AI is used in the future of Cox Auto. I think we've got lots of opportunity, and the hard part will be choosing the right ones. So I love to see that play out. And I think the second piece is anyone runs the data science team, how many bosses have you had, right? You've been reorged. Like, people don't know where to put you a lot of times. Should you live in the CTO's office? Should you live in product? I've been in lots of iterations, and I'm currently in an org that one of the reasons I joined is because I'm in a unique setup, I think, in the way that the org is run, in this intersection of prod and product and technology. And I think it affords me a lot of opportunity. And so that also affords me a lot of thinking about what kind of metrics I need to track on my team. and thinking about how to interface with software engineering even more than I have before, because they have this pretty high functioning scaled agile going on. And it just wakes up a part of my brain that I haven't got, that I always had thoughts about, but I couldn't really do anything about. And now I have the opportunity to kind of see if I'm wrong. Maybe so.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope our listeners have as well.
Take care, y'all.